Paul details the harms we have.
You're listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on Healthcare in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
The other important factor affecting our health has to do with supporting early life. About half of our health as adults has been programmed by age 2. We need policies that support that period that are lacking in any of the material RFK Jr. presents. There are only 2 populous countries that don't have a national policy of giving a working pregnant woman paid time off after she has her baby. One is the United States, and the other is Papua New Guinea, half of a big island north of Australia. We are members of an exclusive club that is killing us. With less economic inequality, we can spend the proceeds on early life and leave Papua New Guinea alone as the only populous country without a national paid maternity leave program. Why is having time and resources to parent important for health? Recall, roughly half of our health as adults is determined then. We have no national program for free childcare, nor preschool, nor support for housing and transportation. Think of our unhoused population, so common now. Back in the 1960s, I saw only 1 homeless person. Now there are everywhere in America. There are many fewer unhoused in Western European nations. Take Sweden as an example of a healthy country that supports early life. There, it is mandatory to take 1.5 years of paid parental leave at your full pay. Your father has to take about 13 weeks. The rest of the second year is optional at 70% pay. In your child's 3rd year, she or he can be placed in a Swedish government-run daycare that is free. To work in such a daycare, you have to have an advanced degree in play. That is what daycare is about, socializing the child, and we need specialists to do that. Stress affects the pregnant woman as well as the fetus and causes worse health problems that continue after you are born. Consider stress as the 21st century tobacco. Few people smoke in the U.S. these days. Those that do are mostly poor, using tobacco to deal with the huge amount of stress they face. When countries are ranked by the amount of stress inhabitants have, the U.S. is right up there near the top. How do we cope with our stress? Consider that we consume about 80% of the world's opioids. Deaths from opioid overdoses number around 100,000 a year. There were very few 75 years ago when we were one of the healthiest nations. You might want to blame big pharmaceutical companies for pushing these drugs, but that source is mostly gone. It's been replaced by fentanyl and others. Why do we consume so much? It works as a stress reliever for a while, but then increasing amounts are needed for the same effect, and eventually an overdose does us in. Recall RFK Jr.'s problems with heroin as a stress reliever in his early years. Why are we so stressed out in the United States? We have all these technologies at our disposal. We can command information in a click or two. Artificial intelligence can provide many answers we seek. And given just about any thought or belief anyone can have, the internet will provide validation of that idea. You can believe anything you want and rest assured you are right. That should be very comforting, but for some reason it isn't. We are incredibly stressed out in America. Another way to relieve stress is with comfort foods, those high in sugar, fat, and salt. To begin with, the U.S. population is not growing in numbers, just in size. The food industry counts on growth, namely producing and selling more food to maintain profits. If there aren't more mouths for the food, then we have to get more food into the mouths we have. How to do that? Increased portion sizes and advertised mouth-watering foods continuously on social media and billboards and everywhere else. Food ads use a variety of tricks to make their products irresistible. Since Americans are some of the most stressed people globally, sugar and fat is added to most ultra-processed foods to make them physiological stress relievers. Changing the food industry tactics won't be easy for governments, as they have many lobbyists whose job is to persuade politicians to get people to eat more. What has been our response? We have a big market for huge caskets, for the embalmed corpses with Gertz, more than doubling in recent decades. You know that being too big is bad for your health, so the corpses are getting younger. Other accommodations include wider movie and car seats, as well as longer seat belts and double-wide wheelchairs. Besides growing the mortuary industry in this country, there are other reasons to be concerned. Infants dying are a sensitive indicator of a nation's health. In the 1970s, a French demographer, Emmanuel Todd, noticed that infant mortality rates were going up in countries of the former Soviet Union. He predicted that the USSR would collapse, although he didn't know when. His book, The Final Fall, an essay on the decomposition of the Soviet sphere, details his findings. The CIA began monitoring infant mortality throughout the world since its rise predicted instability. Guess what? Infant mortality rates are rising in the United States. Are we facing the same outcomes as the USSR collapse? Stay tuned. Are we ready to lower the U.S. coffin into the grave yet? No, I have a plan to stave off writing the obituary. Let's talk about the State of the Union called the United States of America. Article 2, Section 3, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution refers to the President's State of the Union message, stating that the President, quote, shall from time to time give to the Congress information on the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient, end of quote. Almost always, the President orates that the State of the Union is good. There has been only one recent State of the Union address where the State of the Union was not good. Specifically, in 1975, President Gerald Ford said, "I must say to you that the State of the Union is not good. Millions of Americans are out of work. Recession and inflation are eroding the money of millions more. Prices are too high and sales are too slow." He continued, quote, This year's federal deficit will be about $30 billion. Next year's probably $45 billion. The national debt will rise to over $500 billion. Our plant capacity and productivity are not increasing fast enough. We depend on others for essential energy. Some people question their government's ability to make hard decisions and stick with them. We expect Washington's politics as usual, end of quote. Those were President Ford's words. He went on to say, I've got bad news and I don't expect much, if any. There was applause. The American people want action, and it will take both the Congress and the president to give them what they want. That was honest. Today, things are much worse in many, many ways. Just take the national debt, which is well over $37 trillion, or about 75 times what it was in 1975. Not good. So what is the State of the Union of the United States in comparison to other unions? When addressing our health in comparison to that in other nations, we're incredibly sick and die much younger than we should. Let's go back to the 1975 address by President Ford and see how we compare to other unions based on his remarks. I've already covered how much more debt this country have. We have taken on this colossal debt to pay for government expenditures. Remember that the federal government doesn't have to balance its budget. It can borrow to fund programs. Back in the 1950s, when we were one of the longest-lived countries, we had no debt. America incurred debt during World War II to pay for the war effort. That made sense. But it was quickly repaid. Who holds today's record debt? That is, who do we owe money to? U.S. bonds and other securities are held by some countries, such as China and Japan. Other big holders are U.S. corporations, as well as very rich Americans. We have to pay them interest. The annual interest on our $37,000 trillion debt is over $1 trillion. Thus, we increase the wealth of rich Americans and big U.S. corporations by paying them interest. Instead, we could have taxed them and not had the debt. Consider that a third of tax revenues received by the federal government goes to pay interest on our debt. Something has gone seriously wrong here. Instead of raising taxes on the rich, recall they pay the lowest tax rate, to fund the government, the Treasury borrows and then pays interest to those they should have taxed. This is never discussed when decisions are made to borrow more to fund the U.S. Treasury. What about other unions? Do they go into debt similarly to what the U.S. does? The answer used to be no. But as inequality has increased globally, so some other countries now have high debts too. President Ford said too many Americans were out of work. The situation today is very precarious with all the federal job losses making people feel insecure. Average wages adjusted for inflation haven't changed since the 1970s. Yes, we employees are working harder and producing more, but employers are the ones who benefit and make more money. Ford also said that plant capacity and productivity aren't increasing fast enough. Today, with the tariff roller coaster rides, businesses don't know what to do and will mostly try to stand their ground. Tariffs are taxes paid by the importer. We used to call them duties. They will increase prices that Americans have to pay. This is how the federal government is increasing taxes, which are what the tariffs represent. At the same time, by continuing Trump's massive tax cuts on the rich and big corporations, it will be the rest of us who shoulder the burden. The state of the American Union is worse than not good. It is disastrous. What do we have that might be considered the envy of other unions? Vast military might. But that is leading to genocide elsewhere. We have as many billionaires as any other nation does. Billionaires have tremendous power to tell us what to do. Maybe that is not so good, as it erodes American concepts of personal freedoms. What should the president propose in his State of the Union? Something along the lines of, "My fellow Americans, this country has fallen into a state where it can be called a sick society, and our sickness is the system we are in. This has happened before, and we rose to the occasion. Older people that remember 1957 can recall the frightening news that the Soviet Union had launched a satellite, Sputnik, into space that was spying on us. They followed sending a dog into space and then a human. We were caught totally off guard, as we had yet to begin a space exploration program. We vowed to land a human on the moon by the end of the next decade. With a goal, we developed plans and tested components to show we were making progress. And in 1969, August, we showed on real-time television that we had accomplished our goal. The news of this success quickly traveled around the world. While improving our health to become one of the longest-lived nations on the planet is not so visually apparent as stepping onto the moon's surface, we could monitor our progress by posting our living longer, healthier lives in comparison to the other countries on social media, on news reports, and incorporating this into educational materials such as textbooks and whatever is replacing print media in schools. What gets measured gets done. That is what she or he could say. One other strategy would be to encourage more immigration. Immigrants tend to have better health outcomes than those born in the USA. We should knock down the walls and not deport anybody. Supporting immigration will even improve the health of those of us born here. It is a win-win situation. Another perspective on the political medicine we need is what we gave to Japan after the Second World War that made that country the healthiest country in the world by 1978. During the U.S. occupation of Japan, we wrote their constitution. The country was forbidden to have an army and had to resolve all disputes peacefully. There was a clause in the Constitution making the government responsible for the health of its citizens. Labor unions were also legitimized there. The large corporations were broken up, and the most successful land reform program in history was carried out. We also legislated a maximum wage in the country. Japan then enjoyed the most rapid decline in deaths ever seen on the planet and became the longest-lived nation by 1978. What we gave them is a tested and proven medicine. How do we create awareness of our health being so poor? Unlike the Sputnik launch, where we could see a picture of the satellite and hear the signals being broadcast by the satellite from space, there's no image of our health as a nation to present. One challenge in getting these ideas across was voiced by Upton Sinclair years ago when he unsuccessfully ran for governor of California. He found that it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. That is what we face in this country. People are paid to not understand what is happening and why. Critical thinking has all but disappeared from the educational process. But there are ways to change that. One way to make younger people aware of our plight is to put the question, "How healthy is America?" into the standardized tests we take beginning before high school. Follow this with questions on the SAT and other exams we take to get into college. Then specialty tests such as the MCAT or Medical College Admissions Test or the LSAT, Law School Admission Test, and others. Even the exams that medical students take to become doctors lack them. If such questions were on the test, then we would prepare students to be able to answer them. Even public health schools are not required to compare U.S. health with that in other nations. So even our supposed experts are not aware of our being dead first. Another strategy would be to seed our entertainment channels with the state of our nation's health. Movies almost never feature the plight of poor people who have the worst health here as major characters. Hollywood caters to large ticket office receipts as the values that drive production. A wild and crazy idea would be to subsidize the entertainment industry the way the government used to subsidize research to produce new drugs that were then handed to the pharmaceutical industry to amass huge profits. Having a healthy country would make us more productive and innovative. The values of our federal government are taking us in the opposite direction. Looking further afield, the global goal would be for all nations to tie for the gold medal in the Health Olympics. Trying to accomplish this would change the structure of the world system and end the exploitation that has brought us to this dangerous precipice. Sound crazy? Of course. But presidents can inspire and act as many have in the past. That the political party that takes this challenge on is almost surely to be reelected. A Chinese proverb says, if we do not change direction, we'll end up where we are heading. None of us wants to be sick so long and die so young. The ship of state needs to change direction. Nothing is more powerful than an idea whose time has come. Don't mourn or agonize. We must organize or die. Thank you.
You were just listening to Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on healthcare in America. He spoke in Seattle in late September. Stephen Bezruchka is on the faculty of the Department of Health Systems and Population Health at the University of Washington. He worked for many years as an emergency physician in Seattle. He's the author of Inequality Kills Us All. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as David Corton, Winona LaDuke, Jesse Hagopian, Amy Goodman, and Claudia de la Cruz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting for free, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Dr. Stephen Bezruchka on Healthcare in America, and for his book, Inequality Kills Us All, call us 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Jesse Wells, United Health.
There's an office in a building and a person in a chair, and you paid for it all, though you may be unaware. You paid for the paper, you paid for the phone, you paid for everything they need to deny you what you're owed. They know you in United Health, they know me in the company, they know us in the private trust. There's hardly humans in humanity. Now the procedure that you're needing ain't the cost-effective route, and only 2% of people end up winning a dispute. So if you get sick, pray to God for help, 'cause your doctor's gotta pray to United Health. Way back in 77, Mr. Richard T. Burke started buying HMOs, putting federal grants to work, made 50 billion buckaroos. Last year, the Warren Buffett of health, the Jeff Bezos of fear.
CJSF is 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Doctors and nurses can help educate patients about the links between climate change and health problems like asthma, heat stress, and Lyme disease. But research shows that many healthcare providers hesitate to raise the topic with their patients. Some feel unqualified to discuss it.
Another issue is just feeling like there's not enough time to talk about climate change.
Ben Fulgencio Turner is with Climate for Health, a program led by the nonprofit EcoAmerica. The group offers a free online course and other resources for healthcare professionals about the links between climate and health, and how to easily bring that information into the conversations they're already having with patients.
The goal of that is to both get over that initial barrier of feeling like this is outside of their lane or they don't know enough, as well as giving a structure and framework for having climate conversations.
For example, talking about the risks of exposure to extreme heat or wildfire smoke can fit right into a conversation about reducing asthma triggers or staying safe during a pregnancy. So his group is helping build a network of doctors and nurses who are better prepared to protect patients in a warming world. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Something curious. Something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m. your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.